I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
I'm Greg Oliar. 4 years ago, I stopped writing novels to report on the crimes of Donald Trump and his associates. In 2018, I wrote a best-selling book about it, Dirty Rubles. In 2019, I launched Prevail, a biweekly column about Trump and Putin, spies and mobsters, and so many traitors! Trump may be gone, but the damage he wrought will take years to fully understand. Join me and a revolving crew of contributors and guests as we try to make sense of it all. This is Prevail.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. One rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich, and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 106 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, February 1st. I'm your host, Allison Gill. With me, as always, real-life lawyer and real-life friend, Andrew Torres. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Allison. How are you?
I'm good. It's shaping up to be a busy news week already, and we have a lot to talk about today, including Navarro's trial being pushed back a little bit. We're going to talk about who Chertoff is and what's going on with the Supreme Court investigation into the Dobbs leak. And of course, new information coming out of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. I think he's appointed a special grand jury to look into the hush money payment. Finally? So anyhow, here we are, which is, you know, also weird. Why doesn't he have a special grand jury to look into all the tax fraud or or anything else going on? But regardless, we're going to talk about that. And but first, we should talk about our patrons because they're awesome.
They are indeed. So a big shout out. Remember, if you head on over to patreon.com/aisle45pod, that's AISLE45POD, and sign up at any level. That is a buck an episode. Then you will get a shout out here. If you sign up at the $2 an episode level, you will get twice as much cleanup on aisle 45. We do a special bonus episode for patrons every week. It comes out on Friday and it is raw, unexpurgated. I swear a lot and a lot of fun. So those of you joining us this week are Judy Narvid, Tam D, Dave M, Ezekiel Bacon's Grounds, Kiel Camfjord, Tim Scott, Janelle, and Wendy Cano. Take it away, Allison.
Yes, we also have new patrons Dabia, Sam, Jill Kahn, Greg Eldridge, Dustin the Gay Atheist Black Sheep of the Family Baez, Tim New, or Noy, could be, and we have Bryson King, and finally, find out if your relative was there on January 6th by taking a 2383andMe test.
Love it.
2383andMe.
I'm thinking of that great bit from The Simpsons where it's like, that's a joke that not one in a million people would get.
I love it. I love it.
Our listeners are the best.
Yes, absolutely. So thanks again for being patrons. You make the show work. All right. I'd like to kick this off, if it's cool with you, about what's going on with this new news, the breaking news. Manhattan District Attorney will begin presenting the Trump case to a grand jury. And the lead here is Alvin Bragg has a decision. This represents a dramatic escalation of the inquiry and potentially sets the case on a path toward criminal charges against the former president. So he apparently has impaneled a special grand jury about Trump's role in paying Stormy Daniels, you know, for her silence, which is, you know, I assume you wouldn't impanel a grand jury unless you were trying to bring indictments. But this grand jury is impaneled for 6 months, generally. I don't know if they will use the entire 6 months, but it could be a while before, and if any charges are brought, that's up to the grand jury. My question for you is a little bit about the statute of limitations, because it's 5 years, but I know Cuomo told it for a minute, like 8 months during COVID, said he's pausing all criminal and civil statutes of limitations because of COVID. And if that last check that we've all seen that was written at the end of 2017 is in fact the last payment, then that means we have until about May of this year. But there are, and I have heard from a few people who I've spoken to on the condition of anonymity, that there was actually a payment made in late 2018 as well. So that could give us until well into next year, May of next year. So what are your thoughts on this? Why now? Why didn't he do this before? I guess maybe Vance didn't do this before. And why this particular crime when he's got so many other crimes to choose from?
Yeah, and I want to drill down on the particularity of the crime in a second, because again, this is a black box at this point, so we are speculating. I also want to add, because we're speculating, in civil cases, right, your cause of action for which there is a particular time limit, right, under which there are any applicable statutes of limitation, that begins to run with what is called the discovery rule. The discovery rule says your cause of action begins at the moment you knew or should have known that there was a civil wrong committed against you, right? So in other words, for things like fraud, for example, if it's well concealed, your statute of limitations, be it 3 or 4 years, doesn't begin to run until the earliest moment at which anybody could have possibly known that there was something to go after, right?
And so perhaps in his investigation of all of this Trump org stuff, maybe he found this other payment that extended the statute of limitations.
That's certainly possible. But also think about this in the context. So for example, right, there is not a statute of limitations for murder, right? But imagine if there was, right? It's very, very easy to know when the statute of limitations begins to run on a murder. That is the moment at which the dead body is discovered, right? You would say, okay, that starts the clock. When you were talking about a business fraud, right? And that's the crime, one of two crimes that it is suspected that Alvin Bragg may be asking the grand jury to consider charging Donald Trump with. How does one can only uncover a fraud when some evidence of that presents itself? So again, I we don't know the particular statute. I don't know how that's been handled in the New York courts, but I do know that analogously, right, in civil litigation, that lack of discovery, the impossibility of knowing that this happened, means that the clock doesn't start to run until the moment where a reasonable person would say, something wrong has happened. And when did we know that something wrong has happened? Like that would have been in 2018, right? When this evidence began to come out. So there may be a couple potential vehicles, right? That's one way is to say, look, these charges have to be brought within 5 years of issuing the illegal payments to Michael Cohen, right? Because that's the criminal wrong, and that's when the clock starts to run. And then your suggestion, which is true, is for an ongoing criminal activity, the start of the clock is delayed until the very last, till the crime is completed, right? Till the evidence of the very last part of that crime continues. So if you have a year's worth of payments, that gets extended for a year into the future. And similarly, if it is told by order of the executive during COVID, that gets to add some time back onto the clock. And that may get us to May. And I'm suggesting that if there is a discovery rule, that may also be a way to add some time onto the clock. So put all of that kind of in bucket number one.
We saw that in the Manafort case because, he was doing that, his fraud and money laundering for like a decade.
Yep.
And so as long as he kept on doing it, and we would say if as long as Trump keeps criming, that statute of limitations isn't going to start tolling as long as it's part of the same actions, part of the same crime. Right. I mean, how does that work?
Right.
Because,
yeah,
you can't extend a statute of limitations on business fraud if he shoots somebody in the face. Right. That's
right.
A different,
yeah.
Different crime.
Yeah, it has to be the same common nucleus of operative facts. But also, again, think about it. What it would imply, minus any kind of discovery rule analysis. And again, we need to know the specific statute and how the courts have handled it. But a discovery rule analysis is going to be employed in some sense, because otherwise, basically what you're saying is, if you can plan the perfect crime, right, then you could never get charged, right? So in other words, if it is impossible for someone to discover your crime until the end of the period in which the statute of limitations operates, then you would just sort of incentivize better criminal schemes the better criminal schemes are the ones you definitely want to, you most want to prosecute. So there's going to be some kind of analysis of, hey, when did this clock start running for purposes of computing that 5-year period? What are the time periods in the middle in which it stopped running? And that will be an interesting question. That backs us up to the why are we doing this in 2023? I don't have a great answer for that.
Right. And part of my job when I was an internal auditor for a corporation was to find stuff like that. People would hide things for long enough to not be noticed. For example, if you were a sales rep at my company and you got a commission for selling a thing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, you have 3 months in which to be charged back if that person returns the item. But what they would do is that they would give them 3 free months of the service so that it wouldn't cancel until after that window passed.
Right.
And I found about $1.5 million of fraud on that trick alone. So I totally understand that. But yeah, why now and why these crimes? But we could talk for an hour about that. But you mentioned 2 crimes here that are purportedly being investigated. And I'm assuming one of them is lying about, because Trump said he was paying legal fees to Michael Cohen instead of reimbursing him for a second mortgage he took out to pay off Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
Why did you have your fixer take out a second mortgage to do that? I'll never understand, but...
That's the definition of a good fixer, willing to mortgage his house for you.
And cover up, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one crime, is, falsifying business records. What's the other?
So the other would be an analog of the federal election crimes, right? A New York State election crime that says, hey, look, what you have done is essentially made an in-kind campaign contribution. That's right. And so if you are looking for any good faith explanation for holding off, that might be we're going to give the Federal Elections Commission every opportunity to investigate this and get involved. And, the FEC is irrevocably broken, as we have talked about on this show on multiple occasions. So they have taken a pass. They are very clearly not interested in looking at 2016 campaign expenses. I talk to Beth Kingsley, who does this sort of thing for a living. And one of the things that she emphasized to me is that in these elections law cases, the definition of thing of value is necessarily very broad, right? And so the idea that you would, right? So for example, if this were a bribery case, right? We know from the Bob McDonnell case that went 9-0 before the Supreme Court, right? That just, you know, seemed like the classic movie case of bribery, right? Like bad guy executives at garbage. I think it was a supplements company. I mean, whatever. Like a bad guy at garbage company gave Bob McDonald's wife a fur coat, like let Bob McDonald use his Ferrari, like rent free, gave literal bags of money. I mean, it was just gross. And in exchange, McDonald like walked around arm in arm with this guy and, you know, told all the Republican legislators, hey, man, you know, do what you can here for Mr. Scumbag, because, you know, that's really, really important to me. And as a result, you know, Virginia passed a bunch of laws that that benefited Mr. Scumbag. And the Supreme Court 9-0 reversed and said, look, bribery, quid pro quo, requires that the quo be a governmental function, right? Must be something officially that you've done. So if I give you a sack of money for you to vote a certain way, that's bribery. But if I give you a sack of money and what you do is kind of like make me your friend, well, the statute doesn't criminalize that. I think that's a preposterously stupid rule. I think that's an implausible construction of the statute. But, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg signed onto it, and she was way smarter than I am, so maybe I'm wrong on this. And again, if we had a functioning legislature, the response would be to come back and fix the bribery statute. Instead, what we have is, you know, half the government is a kleptocracy of morons. And so, you know, the Republicans were like, yeah, no, we like the fact that those are what the bribery rules are. And by the way, keep giving money and we'll keep introducing you around for entree, which the Supreme Court has now blessed. So that digression is just meant to contrast, right? Bribery, the quo is incredibly narrow. It must be an official political act. In federal election law, and I presume in New York law, although, you know, this is sparsely litigated. That's the kind of the takeaway that I want you to do. But in federal election law, the thing that must be given is anything of value. And the case law is robust and deep that lots of things count as things of value, and that clearly would include a journalist burying a story that is hostile to your case. So,
yeah, and one would think that opposition research on Hillary Clinton would be considered a thing of value, but you know
how much that because you pay somebody to do it, so by definition that is a thing of value. Yeah,
with regard to the Trump Tower. But yeah, there are entire companies who make livings and send their kids to very expensive private schools on oppo research. But we, you know, the Southern District of New York shut down this hush money case under Barr. Not that they would have indicted a sitting president anyway. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see in FOIA those memos of the shutdown of that particular case, too. And so now here's Alvin Bragg, I guess, trying to be cool like Fonnie Willis and going forward with impaneling a special grand jury to look into these hush money payments, but giving a sweetheart deal to Weisselberg for no reason and not going after the obvious tax fraud. That just kind of blows my mind a little bit. But here we
still,
are.
Still blows mine. And let me point out, any financial crime with which Donald Trump is charged, Alan Weisselberg is a necessary witness. So, again, there was a time period in which Alvin Bragg had maximum leverage over Alan Weisselberg. That was prior to entering a plea deal, when he had a case that would have presumably resulted in Bragg serving 5 to 10 years in prison, and Alvin Bragg gave Weisselberg time served in exchange for nothing. And so I railed about it at the time. I'm railing about it now. And again, what I want to be clear with here is, and this will sort of close the loop on, you know, some folks who, you know, tried to defend that deal was not and is not contingent on cooperation. That was why I was critical of it at the time. That's why I'm critical now. And so if Weisselberg says, hey, I'm not going to cooperate, right in connection with your efforts to prosecute Trump over the Stormy Daniels stuff. And I'm the guy who signed all of the reimbursement, quote unquote, to Essential Consulting. And I'm going to get on the stand and go, I don't remember. Your recourse there is to bring a separate indictment against Weisselberg for perjury. And now you're in a place where that is a harder crime to prove than the very obvious tax fraud, which was super easy to prove. We had the documents, we had the receipts. And so, people.
Yeah, and not being able to squeeze Weisselberg might be why they're going with the hush money payment case, because noted witnesses for Alvin Bragg are Dylan Howard and David Pecker. And my question for you now, after closing that particular loop over on the Weisselberg end, I'm going to open another loop here. David Pecker had a limited use immunity agreement with him and AMI, and he seemingly violated, because if you have an immunity deal, you aren't allowed to break any more laws while you're right. helping cooperate. And this was with the feds. This was with the Southern District of New York. And you aren't allowed to break any more laws. And he actually blackmailed Jeff Bezos by threatening to release photos of his, I guess, mistress, for lack of a better term, somebody he was having an affair with. Bezos came out and wrote a whole article about it and just exposed himself. We did a whole episode on it called Bezos Exposes Pecker. and seriously, dust off all the Pecker jokes, because I'm here for it. But I'm wondering how that immunity with the feds could impact him as a witness here. Is that why he's a witness and not being charged? Or maybe because he violated that immunity deal, Alvin Bragg was able to squeeze him to cooperate, and maybe there's a plea agreement in the works. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to sort of remind everybody about that Pecker immunity.
And I am 12, so those jokes didn't even need to be dusted off as far as I'm concerned. No, here's the thing. I agree with 100% of your analysis. For purposes of requiring Pecker to testify before the grand jury, you want that immunity deal to be in place, right? Because that means Pecker can't plead the fifth when you ask him in front of the grand jury, did you and Donald Trump collude to kill the Stormy Daniels story? And Pecker says yes, as opposed to I declined to answer on the grounds that my answer might tend to incriminate myself. So if there's a doubt in the immunity, that's going to come up at a later point in time when you're working with Pecker as a witness and assessing the degree to which he's cooperating. And again, this is not a speculative thing. It's not even a speculative thing in Trump world, right? Like we saw this happen repeatedly in the Mueller investigation when, you know, there were reports that, so-and-so had, I mean, there were reports that Manafort had flipped, right? And what we learned was that they remained loyal to Trump and were lying. And so that happens to prosecutors, right? You have somebody that you think is cooperating in your investigation, and you get halfway through and you realize that they're lying. You then table the question of, okay, what am I going to do to punish this guy for lying to me? Which, let me tell you, you table, but you come back to, right? Prosecutors do not like being strung along by Paul Manafort, and that's part of why they were incredibly tenacious in going after Manafort.
If Pecker decides to be a dick, then you have this other potential crime.
That's right. That's right.
And you can always immunize him anew.
That's right. And so my point, and you're right to kind of nudge me back on track there, is that if at some point, suppose this leads to presenting a case against Trump before the grand jury, and you put Pecker on and you realize that, like, okay, this is probably going to be enough to indict, but now I'm worried about him as a prosecution witness, right? Because, again, the standards are different, right? You, you prosecute someone, you want to prove that they are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, not merely that there is sufficient evidence to issue an indictment, right? And so that threshold escalates radically, and you might say to yourself, okay, we've got to go back and make sure we clear things up with Pecker here. And having more leverage is always better than having less leverage.
Yeah.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
That's very true. All right, so we will keep an eye on this special purpose grand jury and see if Alvin Bragg talks a lot about it, or does a Garland and doesn't talk about it at all, or does a Jack Smith and writes a bunch of letters that we get to read. Who knows? We'll keep you posted on everything that is publicly available. And of course, by any of our anonymous sources, which are few and far between, but we do have some, we will let you know. We're going to take a quick break right now, but we're going to be back to talk about what's going on with the Navarro case. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi there, Diana Erickson here, host of the podcast One Sweet Dream, which is a podcast that shines new light on the Beatles, illuminating their story in ways not seen before. This podcast does deep storytelling to get to radical new ideas and insights that transform our understanding of their story. We've always known the Beatles story was exciting and epic, but there is an even bigger, better, sexier, and more beautiful story that's been hiding in plain sight. And that's what I want to share with you. Historians say that it takes about 50 years to tell the story of an event properly. And so here we are, a little over 50 years later, and have I got a great story to tell. So I hope you'll join us at One Sweet Dream Podcast, where we explore the dream that was and is the Beatles. Episodes will be released every Tuesday and Friday, so please subscribe to One Sweet Dream wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, Andrew, what the frick is going on with the Navarro case? Because I read Meta's dismissal of Navarro's motion to dismiss his contempt charges, and Meta was like, "You don't have immunity. There's no such thing as blanket immunity for, you know, based on your OLC memos that apply to Kellyanne Conway and her Hatch Act violations in the Department of Justice." But now he's saying that there are questions about privilege and absolute immunity for presidential advisors that didn't apply to Bannon, and is asking the government to sort this out, which is delaying the trial. Can you give us a little information on what's happening?
Yeah, that is exactly right. So Friday, there was a hearing that was cleaning up a bunch of outstanding pleadings in the Navarro case. Trial was scheduled for this past Monday, January 30th. And at the end of that hearing, Judge Maeda struck the trial from the schedule and scheduled briefing on this question of executive privilege with the government's brief due end of February, February 28th, the Navarro's response due by March 21st, and then the government's reply brief due March 31st. That is slightly accelerated on the schedule, but a pretty generous briefing schedule. And then it also necessitated, if you are like me, the kind of person that reads the docket entries, they're like four or five set, reset, speedy trial deadline docket entries. And basically what happens in cases like that is that Navarro, because he's a rich white dude connected to Donald Trump, or, you know, not connected to Donald Trump, rich white dudes generally for nonviolent crimes are released on their personal recognizance. So, you know, he's not in prison. And so if you ask him, hey, would you like to postpone into the future the date in which you might be put into prison? The answer is yes, I very much would like to postpone that into the future. But you also have to cover your backside if you are the prosecutors, because if you do so and it is not clear for the record that that delay is something that the defendant has waived as part of their Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial, you might find that, you know, you get to that point in the future, everybody's agreed to kind of push stuff forward, but nobody has made a sufficient record. And now all of a sudden the defendant says, no. I mean, one of the few things that's super clear in the Constitution is, right, I'm criminally charged. I have the right to a speedy trial, and this has not been speedy. So agreed upon delay, because Navarro is out on personal recognizance. He will remain out on personal recognizance until the resolution of this, and briefing will not end for 2 months. So yeah, I think a lot of us were surprised by this. And a big reason to be surprised was because of just how bad the motion for reconsideration with the attached affidavit that we talked about at some length on Thursday's opening arguments, just how bad that was. It was the sort of time travel, a letter from Evan the Cork Corcoran saying that, oh yeah, no, President Trump definitely 100% meant to tell you to assert executive privilege on his behalf. And the fact that he's never said that in public until now must just be some kind of crazy random, we don't know why that is, but he's saying it now about a thing that happened in the past. And that, if you were at that hearing, that was not an issue that Judge Maeda really struggled with very much, right? That first half we talked about on this show, the first half of Judge Maeda's ruling that denied most of the that denied the motion to dismiss filed by Navarro and granted most of the government's motions in limine about what Navarro could and couldn't raise a trial that we talked about, noticed that executive privilege argument was contingent upon the president actually manifesting an assertion of executive privilege at the time, and there was no such evidence in the record. And Judge Maeda continued to point out that there was no such evidence in the record now, and that that a letter dated January 23rd, 2023, by the former president's current lawyer about what might have happened in, you know, that doesn't change anything. You got to present it at the time. But
yeah, what does change it?
What does change it is the question of what position the Department of Justice is allowed to maintain in front of Judge Maeda. And by that, I mean a very specific thing. So we've talked about how Office of Legal Counsel memoranda are just that. They are memoranda. They are, you know, what we call sternly worded crunch wraps over on opening arguments. They are not binding on any court whatsoever because it is a legal office staffed by the president. And so particularly on issues that relate to the role of the president vis-a-vis the role of the judicial system, the Office of Legal Counsel tends to take maximalist positions, right? You heard, we talked about at great length, you broke down in more detail than any non-lawyer ever has the OLC memoranda that say you can't indict a sitting president, and they and they date back to totally self-serving statements from the Nixon administration, right? But those positions, while they're nothing more than sternly worded crunch wraps to the court, are binding on executive branch agencies. You cannot take a position that is not clearly supported by an OLC memorandum. In other words, if the Office of Legal Counsel says it is our considered view that high-level staffers are immune from compelled congressional testimony, even if they are former staffers, then the Department of Justice can't take an opposite view.
But DOJ,
I'm
sorry to interrupt, but DOJ did weigh in on the Meadows case and said there's no such thing as blanket immunity for advisors to the president, and we can indict Meadows if we want. But I think that was more of a blanket immunity and might have been a different OLC memo that they were trying to raise, but I feel like it was the same memo.
Yeah, no, the argument that they raised in the Meadows case is, I think, the same argument that they are going to raise here, and that is that they are parsing the language, even though you can find language in its 44 OLC 1 that suggests that or that explicitly says this applies to both present and former staffers. I think what they're going to do, what they did with Meadows, is to say, right, but when you look at the analysis only applies to present staffers, and there is no guidance about when that conflicts with the express determination made by the current executive to either not assert or, as in this case, to waive executive immunity with respect to their testimony. Yes.
So they have not. Is it that they haven't argued that in this Navarro case? And if not, why not?
It's that they haven't had to reach that in this Navarro case until now, because you could very easily just say, oh, there was no. And in fact, we highlighted this line before Navarro went and got Evan the Cork to, you know, retroactively assert privilege. You could say, oh, yeah, this would be a very different case if this were Mark Meadows, right? Which is word for word what Judge Mehta said in that first section in ruling on executive privilege. I don't have to address the factual record because there's a threshold issue. That threshold issue is, have you asserted executive privilege? The answer is no. So therefore, I don't have to deal with the question of, can Biden waive that privilege and therefore allow the current DOJ to be consistent with a memorandum that says the privilege applies to both current and former staffers?
When was the first time Navarro raised the argument of the OLC memo? And I guess my question is, why didn't the DOJ respond to Navarro's argument when he first raised it the same way they responded or the same way that they weighed in on the Meadows the situation? I mean, it's the same argument. Why are we? I don't understand why the DOJ either didn't make the argument before or isn't saying now, like, oh, we already did this here. We did it in the Meadows case. I don't understand what's taking so long.
No, and I'm really glad because this is helping me, you know, sort of sharpen as we're explaining this out to the listeners. That was argued. That has been briefed, and that was argued, but it was not decided, not even as dicta, by Judge Mehta up until this point, right? So, in other words,
it was argued but not litigated.
It was argued and litigated, but Judge Mehta sort of said, "Hey, I don't have to weigh in on this because those OLC memoranda only apply when there is a clear assertion of executive privilege." So, for example, right, on and so this is the opinion that Judge Mehta issued. And I know you do, and I want to make 100% clear, because if I lost you prior to now, then I've definitely lost some of our listeners. So let's make sure that we get this exactly right. So page 10 of that Judge Mehta ruling, and again, this is the day before they got Evan the Cork to travel back in time and issue, you know, this, well, we meant to, right? It says, relying on a OLC opinion from July 12, 2019, Navarro insists that as a senior advisor of the president, he was not required to appear before the select committee, even on non-official matters, right? The cited opinion, however, does not stand for such a broad proposition. The opinion concerned a congressional subpoena to Kellyanne Conway, senior advisor to President Trump, about her alleged violations of the Hatch Act. OLC reaffirmed its longstanding opinion that Congress may not constitutionally compel the president's senior advisors to testify about their official duties. Because the subject of the subpoena testimony plainly concerns Ms. Conway's official duties, OLC concluded that she could not be compelled to appear for testimony. The OLC opinion, therefore, does not suggest that the senior advisor of the president can resist a congressional subpoena on matters related to his unofficial acts. Okay, so in other words, at that time, they were citing the OLC memoranda for the proposition that doesn't matter whether the president ever asserts it, I get to assert it on his behalf. It doesn't matter whether it is for official or unofficial acts. Like, it's just blanket. I get a get out of jail free card and I don't have to show up. And Judge Mehta said, no. That's not how I read that issue. But it doesn't matter because you don't have any presidential assertion, so I don't have to rule based on it. And now, if there's some assertion in the record, right, that there was a privilege being asserted at the time, now what Judge Mehta wants to know is, DOJ, you tell us how, in light of your view of these OLC memoranda, which are binding on what you can argue in this court, even though they're not binding on how I can rule in this court, how you can advance these arguments. How can you stand for this proposition when this particular page in this particular memo seems to suggest that prior staffers enjoy immunity, may not be compelled to testify about their official duties. And now we have a letter that says this January 6th committee is going to ask you about your official duties. So I'm ordering you not to show up, right? So put all that together. Much of the briefing has already been done, which is why I'm a little surprised at the length of time that this is going to add on to the schedule. It is possible that Judge Mehta needed to move out the trial date. Then, in other words, you know, once you were no longer going to trial in January, right, he may have not had an open trial date on his calendar until April. And so it may not matter, right? That's just, our courts are ridiculously overworked. So that's one plausible
explanation. Back to doubling the federal
bench. Yep. So, look, here's how I put all that together. I'm surprised on the one hand, but not surprised, right? Like one of the praise that we have individually and collectively heaped on Judge Mehta is that this is a thorough individual. Yeah. And so, you know, what you want to do, and this, you know, among lawyers, right, we call it bulletproofing your opinion on appeal, right?
He doesn't want his shit to be overturned on appeal.
Yeah, you do. Trump's going to argue this, and you don't want the D.C. Circuit to say, oh, wait, you never evaluated the substance, the merit of this particular claim. Okay, well, we're going to reverse and remand with instructions for you to evaluate. He doesn't want that. So close all those doors. Let's make sure. You know, in the articles that were written about that hearing, I tried to attend that hearing. I dialed in and the number didn't connect me in. So I really did try to attend it Friday morning. And I will tell you that in the public reporting from folks who were actually in the courthouse, the question was essentially characterized of, you know, this is a criminal case, right? And so, you know, one of the lines quoted in CNN was, seems to me you ought to have some pretty clear lines before you prosecute someone. End of quote.
Okay. So this is a lot like the DOJ wanting to tie up that one last 1512C2 end with Judge Nichols to make sure that the Supreme Court won't overturn any convictions for people charged with 1512C2 based on that one differing federal judge opinion and a misinterpretation of the statute.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent analogy. And, you know, it as we said, I am looking forward to Peter Navarro getting his 4 to 6 months in federal prison for having told the select committee, you know, where can stick it.
Do you think Meta will have to allow him out pending appeal because they let Bannon out pending appeal?
I think they will look to that for guidance. I don't think he has to, but I think he will.
Yeah, and, similarly you know, situated yeah. shit and all that yep. stuff.
I think that's Fuckers. I think that's right. And yeah, no, I know right. it's well, but you know, it's
well, we got bigger fish to fry too.
We do indeed.
So, it's just I'm mad that this kind of assholery clogs up the courts with misdemeanors and but you know, again, we need to expand the federal bench. All right, we're yep. gonna take one more quick break. We're gonna come back and talk about Chertoff and SCOTUS and all sorts of weird interesting things that should have been disclosed and conflicts of interest. It's a fascinating story. Stick around, we'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back. Some new reporting, Andrew, about the investigation into the Dobbs leak from the Supreme Court. We yeah. know that the Supreme Court marshal, quote unquote, investigated, and her name was Curley, and she found nothing wrong. And then apparently SCOTUS brought in an independent third party to look at Curley's investigation and say, yeah, this was legit. This was a good investigation. But as it turns out, much like the two people who searched Trump's additional properties for stolen documents were not exactly independent private investigators, this third party that came in to look at the Curley investigation for the Dobbs leak isn't exactly independent either, and SCOTUS failed to disclose the financial ties it has with this person. Tell us about it.
Yeah, let's hit both parts of that. The first is... and I would really love to make a, you know, Three Stooges joke here, but, you know, it's Gail Curley, so it wouldn't quite work. But no, the Supreme Court marshal issued a report that basically excludes all possible sources for the Supreme Court leak of the draft Alito Dobbs opinion that involve any Mission Impossible style stunts, right? So it was like, I talked to all the IT guys and we looked at our records and definitely nobody broke into our files, case closed. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but one of the things that the report conspicuously does not say is whether Marshall Curley even so much as spoke to any of the Supreme Court justices to ask them whether they were the source of the leak. And certainly it does not contain any sworn affidavits. And the day after this, and so then that was turned over to a third party, Michael Chertoff, we're going to talk about that in a second, who looked at this 22-page report and said, there is nothing, I would not do a thing differently. There was nothing that I could think of that would make this any better. And that was just such a preposterously idiotic thing to say. We're going to talk about how idiotic that was. Marshall Curley was required to kind of put out a supplemental statement given how bad the backlash was to her buffoonery of a report here, in which she said, and I think it's really important that we parse the words of a career civil servant very, very closely here. Quote, the justices actively cooperated in this iterative process, asking questions and answering mine. I followed up on all credible leads, none of which implicated the justices or their spouses. End of quote. That is a far cry from I am the investigator and I sat down with each of the Supreme Court justices and asked them explicitly, did you leak this document to anyone? Did you ever share this document with anyone? That's very clearly a, yeah, when I talked to the justices, I asked them, you know, what members of their staff would I talk to or that sort of thing, right? Like, this is just...
Right. Nobody, and she didn't have him sign any affidavits. And, you know, and we've known, you know, now for a couple of weeks that that whole investigation was bullshit.
Correct.
But now we're piling bullshit on top of bullshit because we have, is it Michael Chertoff? Michael?
It is. It is.
Good
it
old
is former,
Mike.
Yeah. Homeland Security Secretary under George W. Bush, who, by the way, the president who appointed Samuel Alito to the bench.
Oh, interesting. And so now we've got Chertoff coming in, who's got a consulting company who's been paid at least $1 million in the past by the Supreme Court to consult on security and I don't know, whatever. So certainly worth at least $1 million. And the Supreme Court didn't disclose that they had this financial relationship with the guy who's supposed to come in and say that this investigation is on the up and up. But I think the thing that stood out to me the most that I didn't know, Andrew, is that the Supreme Court doesn't have to disclose its contracts.
So, yes to all of that. Let's unpack
We don't
it.
Know how much they gave to Chertoff because they don't have to disclose that. Shit. What is that?
The Federal Judicial Code of Ethics is voluntary but non-binding on Supreme Court justices.
Trust us.
And if that is the kind of thing that appalls you, you know, I have had on our buddy Gabe Roth over at Fix the Court on opening arguments on a bunch of occasions. There are folks, there are watchdog groups. Gabe is one of the very best out there to try and hold the Supreme Court accountable. Look, there are not a lot of ways to do that, right? Supreme Court justices, like all federal judges, hold their terms, like all Article III judges, hold their jobs for life for good behavior. So the only possible removal of a Supreme Court justice is impeachment. Not even disbarment, not even conviction of a crime. They must be separately impeached, or they get to stay on the court so long as, and the standard is good behavior, which, you know, what is that? You know, that's whatever, 2/3 of the Congress says that it is. So, the other thing is that, you know, you have, a chief justice, a relatively young chief justice in John Roberts, who, you know, we have described as an institutionalist who seems to care, at least at some level, about how the court is perceived. And the court is and should be perceived like crap over this, right? This is a case in which, and boy, if you get the patron bonuses from 2 weeks ago, I was rather incendiary on the subject of this bullshit document. But to summarize the facts, you had a credible whistleblower go to the New York Times public with a letter that he sent to the Supreme Court, to the marshal and to John Roberts, saying that, hey, my buddy got a copy of the Hobby Lobby decision, another Alito decision, in advance of that decision coming out, and use that to help kind of build the infrastructure in the right-wing evangelical community for support when that opinion came out. This seems like a direct model of exactly what happened in Dobbs, and it's the same Supreme Court justice. Again, that investigative story came out in the New York Times 3 weeks after Alito piously cried before a Federalist Society panel that, you know, the leaker put all of us in the majority opinion at personal risk because the liberals were going to come kill us, because if they killed us, then, you know, it was just nonsense, right? This is any reasonable inference is it's probably the guy who leaked it the last time. And the 21-page report that is filled out, or I guess it's 20 pages by the marshal, in zero of those pages evaluates whether the leak came from a Supreme Court justice or a Supreme Court justice's activist, crazy, lunatic, QAnon-loving spouse. And the Michael Chertoff, and this finally wraps up your question, the Chertoff group statement that signs off on this and says, Throughout my review, the investigations were transparent, cooperative, and available to answer my questions about the process. At this time, I cannot identify any additional useful investigative measure. Any,
right?
That is a one-page letter appended to the top of it. Again, I have no idea how much Michael Chertoff was paid for that. I'm assuming a lot. And it's just ridiculous to say, you couldn't identify any? Maybe let's talk to the whistleblower, whom is never mentioned in the report. Maybe let's talk to Alito, never mentioned in the report. Maybe let's talk to Jenny Thomas, never mentioned in the report, right? I mean, just preposterous. And so all of that takes us up to the CNN story that broke over the weekend that says the court in recent years has privately contracted with Michael Chertoff's, the Chertoff Group, for security assessments broadly covering justices' safety and some specifically related to COVID-19 protocols at the court itself. The estimated payments to Chertoff's risk assessment firm for consultations that extended over several months and involved a review of the justices' homes reached at least $1 million. The exact amount of money paid could not be determined because, as you point out, Supreme Court contracts are not covered by federal public disclosure rules and elude tracking on public databases.
Okay, quick question for you. Is it a statute that says that these aren't supposed to be put on public databases? Like who decided that, and can that be changed?
So it can be. That is rulemaking. But again, when it covers rulemaking at the court, guess who is the chair of the rules that get to be made? And that is to say, that comes with guidance at the top down from the Supreme Court.
Well, right, but does that mean that the executive branch can just make a rule saying we don't have to disclose our contract amounts and who they go to? They can just do that? That can just be rulemaking within an agency like the Supreme Court?
There you're talking about the Administrative Procedure Act. And so I think there are sufficient guardrails. It would be a super lengthy conversation about if you had precise rulemaking, notice and comment period, and whether you came to the conclusion of you do not have to disclose where the congressional demand is, you must disclose. I think you would have a very good APA case that says that that's ultra-virus. But that's because executive rulemaking is different from judicial rulemaking.
Oh, and, all right. Well, all right. Yeah. Well, how about this? Could Congress pass a law called the Transparency and Justice Act that forces the judiciary to disclose their contracts?
That I believe they could do, yes. And that has to do with...
Unless the Supreme Court overturned it.
Yeah, right, exactly. You have seen the asterisk there. Yeah. Look, these are real issues, and it's why I flagged Fix the Court at the beginning, because the easiest solutions are the public pressure solutions, right? Like, this is the kind of thing that I know our politics are broken, but, like, you ought to say, like, hey, should 64 separate investigations into Brett Kavanaugh have been shut down simply because he was elevated from the Circuit Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court? And I think the average person would say, no, right? Like that shouldn't close those down, but it does, right? Should the Supreme Court have mandatory disclosures that follow best practices on the federal judiciary? I think most people would say, yeah, they should, as opposed to the current situation where they don't. And I think a large part of that is I think people assume, as I did before I started researching it, that, you know, when an ethics guide says it covers the federal judiciary, that since the federal judiciary is defined in Article 3 of the Constitution as one Supreme Court and such lesser courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish, right? Like, you'd think, oh, well, if the federal judiciary means anything, it means the Supreme Court. But when it comes to ethics rules, it doesn't. So that's the role I think we play in this process.
All right. Well, I will continue to play it.
I know you will.
Because that's bullshit. Having worked on federal government contracts, the fact that a government agency where taxpayer dollars pay for their contracts doesn't have to be disclosed of where their money is spent just blows my fucking mind.
Yeah, all right. As well it should.
Yeah, because I can't even apply for a job with any any company whose contract I've been within 10 feet of, you know, not even have to work on it. That's just if I looked at it, or was if I was in the same room, I can't even apply to a job. I have to wait 2 years. So it's that just is confounding to the ethics senses. But yeah, nonetheless, shocked, not surprised when it comes to this particular Supreme Court. All right. That's our show. Wonderful discussion today, Andrew. Thank you so much for answering all my questions. And if you have any questions, you can always attend the next Q&A happy hour live extravaganza for patrons, which we will be scheduling very soon. So keep your eyes open for that. I think we'll probably be able to announce it on next week's show. Do you have anything else you want to cover, Andrew, before we get out of here?
Nothing here.
All right. Well, in that case, I've been Allison Gill.
I'm Andrew Torres.
And this is Clean Up on Aisle 45. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.